At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into some of our introductions and get things rolling here. So welcome everyone, as always, to our FOMC panel. There's a lot of stuff we're going to touch on today, and I'm excited as always to have the panelists here to give us their takes on recent data, especially this morning's CPI drop, and how things look moving forward. Now, as those who frequent our spaces know, I like to keep these panels really open for discussion, really fluid, lots of people chiming in back and left. So as we go, all panelists, please feel free to discuss openly and add your thoughts to any given topic. The only request I have is when someone else is already speaking, please stay muted so we don't have any feedback. And feel free to chime in with your takes on any given topic as we move forward. So to start us off here, we've got Joseph Wang back, our go-to Fed guy. As many of you know, he headed the trading at the Fed's Open Markets Desk, a great, well-renowned introductory book on central banking called Central Banking 101, and he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm always glad to do these panels. I learn a lot from all the panelists, so thanks so much for putting this on.
Thank you so much for coming. Your input is always cherished here, Joseph. Next, we've got another friend of the spaces. Last Bear is back to give us his expertise on markets. He also writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to his Substack, and everyone else here's for that matter, please go do that. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. It's always great to be on this panel, honored to be included on the panel. So looking forward to the discussion today.
As am I. Next, we've got Bob Elliott back. Bob is the CIO at Unlimited Funds, the former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of HFND. He brings vast knowledge and non-reactionary takes. So let's give him a warm welcome. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks so much for having me. This is definitely my favorite space. I look forward to it each time a Fed meeting's coming up. So great to be here.
And great to have you as always, Bob. Thank you. Next, we've got Jem Carson. Jem, a leading volatility expert and founder of Kai Volatility. They're launching tons of new and innovative things in the coming months, including vol tools and more. So check them out. Welcome back, Jem.
Great to be back. It's been a minute since I've been on here. Looking forward to kind of getting to the back nine of election year. It's going to be an interesting last 6 months here.
Yes, sir. And the other speaker we'll have here today, I see him in the audience. We're having some connection issues, but I'll introduce him while we wait for it to work. We have Michael Green, aka Professor Plum. Michael is the chief strategist at Simplify Asset Management, and the portfolio manager of the Simplify Macro Strategy ETF, BIG. Michael's an expert on all things macro and asset allocation, and I'm excited to have him join us today. I think this is the second or third time we've had Michael. So Michael, great to have you back. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Great to see you guys.
Great to see you. Now, to give us a little bit of a macro backdrop since our last FOMC panel, non-farm payrolls far overtook expectations with 272,000 added versus the expected 180,000. On top of that, the CPI climbed 3.3% year over year in May versus the expected 3.4%. with some saying inflation still remaining a little bit more sticky than expected. Median home prices continue to rise while mortgage rates remained around highs. And we'll actually touch on that later because in the CPI print from this morning, rent could be troubling to some. Now, while some central banks abroad have begun cutting rates, strong numbers in the U.S. still have many skeptical about the likelihood of rate cuts from the Fed in the U.S. So where I want to start here today is the hot news topic at hand, and that is this morning's CPI print. Now, as mentioned, we hit that 3.3 versus the expected 3.4. But, Bob, you published a thread this morning discussing CPI remaining too high. You touch on the numbers when adjusted for wage growth, and across all core goods, prices were in nominal income terms. These prices are now making new lows and falling rapidly, including those of used and new cars. You say the current print is likely noise. Can you walk us through that, Bob? What does that mean?
Well, I think if you take a step back and look at how we've gotten to where we are in current inflation, you know, in the mid three range, which is still meaningfully above the Fed's target, a big driver of that shift has been the moderation, really the deflation across a number of different core goods areas, like used cars in particular. And that has just been enough. All of the disinflation, deflation that has existed in those areas has been just enough to bring core down to still being above where it needs to be for the Fed to meet its mandate. For that disinflation pressure to persist, those goods prices have to keep falling at the same pace that they've been falling at over the course of the last 6 or 8 months. And that is probably not going to happen. The reason why that is those prices have fallen considerably. And while already on a backward-looking basis, and while people make a reference point to pre-COVID price levels, I think that is confused because wages and incomes are up 20 to 25% in nominal terms from that point. And so you really want to think about where are those prices today relative to the nominal incomes that people have in their pocket that they're spending with. And there, when you adjust for that, basically what you see is those goods prices are back to where they were pre-COVID on an income-adjusted level or actually a bit lower. And so if we start to see some moderation in the prices of those core goods categories, which have been so critical to creating the disinflationary force, we're going to have to see slowing shelter prices and slowing non-housing core services in order to get core down towards where it needs to be for the Fed's target. And those two things, there's just not a lot of indication that we're going to get there when it comes to housing and shelter costs. You know, it's been pretty stable over the course of the last couple of months, and we're seeing rents start to reaccelerate. And when it comes to core services, ex housing, there's still a lot of wage inflation in the system with ECI, you know, still ECI and all sorts of other measures still printing wage growth rates that are a couple points above where we were pre-COVID. So you put that all together, that picture over the next 6 or 12 months, it doesn't look like a picture that's going to get us to the Fed's target without a meaningful loosening of the labor market or some other external shock. You know, today's data, any one data point, it can be noisy in one direction or noisy in the other. I think there's good reason to believe that this is at least noisy. There's a fair amount of noise on the downside. So I wouldn't go extrapolating here what the figure was from today and just assume that pencil it out into the future and just assume that's what it's going to be, particularly when these sort of longer term dynamics, meaning 6 or 12 month dynamics, still aren't aligned with inflation coming down to the Fed's target in the way it needs to.
So before we deep dive into that, you actually touched on a lot of things that I've got a big list I wanted to hit. But one thing I wanted to touch on in that thread that I quoted you on, Bob, and I'm going to actually pick on Michael here, because in relation to the automotive, Michael, you'd voiced dissent, and I saw that little tit for tat on Twitter this morning, and I knew I had to bring it up, stating financed auto costs remain very elevated and are likely to continue pressuring used vehicles. Michael, can you go over your thoughts on that and the back and forth between you and Bob this morning?
I think it was perceived as more of a back and forth or a tit for tat than I think it was intended to be. I actually did mean what I said. I thought that Bob's analysis was interesting and valuable, although I happen to disagree. I think the core point that he's making is that the levels are likely to remain elevated given the increase in wages that we've seen, right? So this is back to this price level versus price change dynamic. The underlying component, though, that the point that I would make is that prices almost always fall in wage terms. And the reason they do is because you have to make new room for the new stuff that is coming out on a continuous basis. If people desperately want to buy AI and gain access to new technologies, they're going to have to find room in their budget for other stuff that causes trailing technologies or mature technologies to shrink. This is the work of John Fernald at the San Francisco Fed. So I continue to think we're going to see downward pressure until we effectively return back towards that trend line and ultimately continue to move lower and lower. And we'll find that personal transportation continues to fall in costs over time as long as we don't completely screw things up. So my simple view is that we're still quite elevated. We'll continue to see significant downward pressure on the used automotive space unless something substantively changes, like consolidation in the industry or various other components that we've seen in other sectors.
So I do want to touch a little bit more here, and we'll come right back to CPI. But on the topic of rate cuts, Joseph, I'd like to have you start us off here as we kind of just give a precursor to the rest of the panel. Recently, we saw the Swiss National Bank start off that cutting cycle. And since then, we've seen Canada, Sweden, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and now the European Central Bank have followed suit. Joseph, with others cutting rates, will it really have any bearing on the decision by the Fed today?
No, I don't think so, but I would note, though, that so when you look at global central banks, they basically hang out together. They went to the same schools. They have similar economies in the Western world, face similar problems. So they often move together. So we saw a lot of our allies hike together. And now we're seeing the beginning of some of them, like you mentioned, the ECB and Canada cut. And the Fed has, over the past several quarters, repeatedly told everyone that they are thinking about cutting sometime this year. So it seems like that's in the cards for the Fed soon as well. But what the other people do, I don't think it impacts the Fed so much, but I think what the Fed does impacts other people, how other people decide, much more.
Any comments to what Joseph said there?
I would just reinforce what Joseph said, actually. I think that that's actually a very good observation, that they tend to approach the problem in a very homogenous fashion. Once one begins to cut, it creates the cover for others to begin to cut. So I think we're all kind of in agreement that a cutting cycle has commenced on the global stage. It's just a question of, is it appropriate or not?
Fair enough, Michael. Jem, I'd love your thoughts here too. And from what you're seeing, Jem, have we reached a point where policy in the U.S. can be less restrictive, or do you think we're going to be kind of hanging out where we are?
The Fed has been looking for an excuse to cut since they came out in December and told you as much. They haven't had a chance until very recently to have a piece of information that would allow them to. So I think the importance of these numbers, as has been mentioned by Bob and others, is not the actual numbers. We're not getting to 2%, in the next couple of quarters. Actually, quite the contrary. What this does is this allows the Fed to do what they have been wanting to do now for several quarters. So I think that's what's important here. And if the Fed indeed is going to, I believe it will, to begin to stimulate here again. I think there is a very asymmetric effect on the economy. So what do I mean by that? Well, with rates where they are, without a lowering of interest rates, mortgage rates are it's incredibly difficult for people. People are stuck in their homes. Incredibly difficult for people to buy homes. And every little bit on rates here is going to make a dramatic difference. I think there's so much pent-up demand in the real estate market that if we get 50, 100 basis points lower here. I think the amount of stimulus that you see relative to those points is much, much higher than historic, you know, we're historically used to. And I think we saw that, by the way, you know, in December, January, February, part of why, you know, growth and inflation, I think, have been stickier outside of commodities and a few other things was how much the market reacted to that reality of the expectations of those cuts. So I think this is important, not because inflation is actually slowing. It's important because of what it allows the Fed to do. And there's a reason you're seeing the market reaction like you are today. You know, this is a risk on again, much like it was in December when the Fed first came out.
Thank you, Jem. And this that actually slightly curtails me into kind of taking us a little bit back to the housing and rent numbers from CPI. So just a little more backdrop on this. And as was the case from our last panel, even the affordability of owning a home in the U.S. is still dropping. And according to Zillow, it's now cheaper to rent than to own the typical home in the U.S. in all but one of the 35 major metro areas in the U.S. Now, additionally to that, home prices in the U.S. are up 47% since 2020. And with mortgage rates still on the rise, the cost of necessities with inflation, it seems that for most, buying a home is growing further and further away from possible. Now, last bear, I'd love your take on this. And I know I always pick on you about housing, but your responses are always on point. Is the dream of owning a home dying, or do we expect to see those costs of housing to start dropping anytime soon?
I think that a lot of people made, including myself at points, made the mistake of taking sort of a simple perspective, which is, you know, rates and asset prices are inversely correlated. And so higher rates will mean that housing prices are going to come down. And obviously, there's still the scar tissue from global financial crisis and the housing downturn that we saw there, where I think people were conditioned to think that way. But I think if you look at it more holistically, a lot of the arguments that don't necessarily hinge directly on rates have been very important. So I was just looking at vacancy rates for you know, single family homes, still basically at the lowest on record. Their vacancy rates within multifamily rentals have been up a good amount, but for home purchases, they remain incredibly low. And obviously, I think that there's just such a tight demand. I agree entirely with what Sam laid out, which was that to the extent that mortgage rates come down at all, you can just feel the pent up demand ready to, you know, to get excited and people to go out and start shopping. And so I think that that's indicative of the fact that, you know, housing prices are up 47%, but nominal wages are also up a substantial percent in that time period. If you look at housing prices in the U.S. relative to elsewhere in the world, some of us might be surprised, but they're actually fairly reasonable relative to what a lot of other developed economies deal with. And so I think that in totality, it's tough to see a scenario in which housing prices actually come down, particularly if we have a rate cutting cycle like we all sort of expect is going to happen over, you know, the coming months or year, unless there's a serious downturn more broadly economically, where people are unemployed or feel much less secure in their financial position, if banks get tighter on writing mortgages, that sort of thing. But overall, it seems tough to sort of swim against the current, which is that, you know, there's limited supply. It's a very tight market, and interest rates will only exacerbate that.
Yeah, and I know that, like in Canada specifically, the housing just seems to be astronomical, even comparing to, like you said, here in the States, which already seems high. When you look abroad, it does seem to get quite a bit worse. Bob, I see your hand.
Well, I think that housing dynamics are such a good example of how shifts to easing or shifts to expectations of easing in this at this point in the cycle are just very self-defeating. Like, what do we have today? We have, you know, a number that comes in lower than people's expectations, and, you know, bond yields fall a ton and stocks go up. And that's super stimulative, right? And that then, you know, delays any adjustment in the balance between spending and saving. I mean, people will keep spending, and that will continue to flow through to people's incomes, and that will keep the inflationary pressures in place and keep things like asset, like house price pressures in place. And so we're going through another one of these cycles. We've been through, four of these over the last couple of years, where, everyone gets hopped up and hoping for cuts. And then, there's a little financial market loosening, and then those cuts don't happen. And then the economy and inflation's too hot, and then those cuts don't happen. And then everyone gets gloomy, and we just are going through these cycles. And until there is a meaningful change in income growth and driven by labor market dynamics, we're going to be in this state where the underlying need for high interest rates for an extended period of time is not going to change. And anytime we get a whiff that they're going to go lower, it's just going to undermine that dynamic.
Any comments on what Bob and Last Bear said before I spin us into the topic of jobs?
I couldn't agree more with Bob's comments. I think, again, we're just seeing a repeat of December, but to a shorter extent. I think the difference is, I think they will actually cut this time. They really want to, and I think that's for other structural reasons. But again, I think ultimately, they'll have to, pivot back come next year.
So I would unfortunately take the opposite side of that. I do think that they are going to cut. I think that there is a lot of truth to the observations that people are making, that there is pent-up demand in some areas that are interest rate sensitive. And unfortunately, the key issue is that we failed to add supply in those areas. So in a time period in which we understand and acknowledge that housing demand is elevated and that supply is restricted, we've totally failed to add to that. Unfortunately, the higher interest rates have been part of that. I think the flip side of the equation, unfortunately, is that we're starting to see fairly significant rising distress in areas like CRE amongst small businesses. When small businesses start telling you that financing is among and becoming one of their largest problems, it suggests that they are facing imminent disruption as compared to the slow burn of inflation, which is experienced by everyone, right? So I think the real challenge is that we have a very bifurcated economy in which there are quite different interest rates that make sense for different players. I think that's always been the case. And unfortunately, that means that using the risk-free rate to target it is going to create pools of tremendous distress within the economy. It's just a question of how large those were allowed to become during the period of extremely low interest rates.
I mean, I think, Michael, I think we agree on the broad construct. I think the argument, though, that commercial real estate is going to 69 the whole economy as a tail event would assume the Fed and others are not aware of it and not sitting in wait to address it the second it lifts its head again. They've already done that with regional banks. And again, it's pretty much the most talked about thing and has been for about a year and a half now. So, can it cause a short-term hiccup in markets? Sure. But again, I think of it more as a savings and loan crisis that is addressed and dealt with over the course of a decade, and not allowed to rear its head in a really convex way.
I think that's largely true for commercial real estate. The question is, how far does that general process extend itself, right, into private equity, into private credit, across the high-yield corporations that are increasingly zombified? And unable to refinance in a 25 or 50 basis point rate cut is not going to affect that. That's the key question. All right, I could be totally wrong on this, but when we look at an environment in which the mere whiff of a rate cut is enough to get areas of the market that have been largely neglected to begin to respond, it tells you that there's actually real stress out there. And again, the market has been heavily bifurcated, just like the rest of the economy, between a few select stocks that have done extraordinarily well and an environment in which, the Russell 2000 equal weight is basically, totally flat to down for the past 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, this will, at some point here, end poorly, I just don't think it's any time in the next 6 months.
Has anyone had anything to add to Jem and Michael's conversation there before I move along?
I mean, the only thing I'd add on CRE, and I know Michael was talking about a broader set of things, is on CRE. You know, despite the headlines of this office building or that office building, just important to recognize from a lender's perspective. Now, equity holders, they're taking losses. Those are typically unlevered, you know, equity investors like pension funds and stuff. From a bank's perspective, delinquencies in CRE are stable and have been stable over a couple quarters. Those loans are a few hundred basis points in the black in terms of NIM. Charge-offs are 25 basis points right now and pretty stable, not really rising much. Like, these loans are adding to income. You know, banks are meaningfully in the black when it comes to these loans, and they are so on a running basis. And we're so far away from these loans being a risk to the banking system, certainly a systemic risk to the banking system. We're so far away from that. It's like, it's not even close. And, you know, people have all sorts of great, you know, anecdotes about it. But if you look at what's going on in terms of the actual data of it, it's not a problem.
So this all actually brings me more or less to one of the next topics I wanted to talk on, because Michael brought up that notion of commercial credit, very corporate credit, rather, very briefly there. So I just wanted to tickle this a little bit. Corporate debt defaults have hit, I think as of last week or earlier this week, a global tally of 18, the highest monthly level since October of 2020 at the height of the COVID pandemic, according to the S&P Global Ratings. Now, my question here is that something we're projecting to see get worse as rates remain higher for longer? Let's start with Joseph on this one.
So we do hear a lot of anecdotal evidence that there are businesses that are having trouble under the financing and so forth, but it's hard to see that in the data. So when you look at market-based measures like credit spreads, they're very benign. And like Bob mentioned, when you look at the overall banking sector data, when it comes to delinquencies and charge-offs, it's also very benign. And I can drop a chart into the chat. So it seems like, well, there could be things under the surface. Like Mike mentioned, we have a bifurcated market, that there is a certain segment of the market that's struggling, but overall, it seems like it's contained. And if we are embarking upon a rate cut cycle, then I think things could actually get better.
Anybody else have an opinion on that one? Do you think we'll be seeing a bettering, or is it just going to keep getting worse on the corporate level?
I think it's a function of timing, as it usually is. I think the reality is that pressures are building, to Bob's point and to Joseph's point. Like, we're not there yet. I think the next move is likely, as we've kind of stated on here, towards stimulus and continued kind of a continuation of both the rally and an increase in inflation and economic kind of support that comes again. But I do think time matters, because companies, you know, entities do have to come back to the market at some point. You know, that can be a significant draw on things over time as a function of time. You know, venture rounds have been down about 75% across the board. But a lot of these companies haven't had to come back to market yet because they raised money for 3 to 5 years. You know, that was 2 years ago or so. So I think these things matter. I think time is an important component. I think in the short term, we're in election year. We're going to get extra fiscal stimulus. We're going to get extra kind of Fed support. But it's also a function of the tail. You know, eventually we'll go high enough and things will get unpinned enough and time will progress so that the liquidity will be forced out of the system quickly. And then the problem will probably be too big to handle. And that's just kind of how markets move along their path. And so I think to step in front of it here is a mistake. But I do think, you know, we're getting to the later innings.
Last bear, I saw you unmuted there as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to some of those comments. I guess the first point being that I think that Bob and Joseph made good points around bank data, and that data is obviously very easily accessible. I look at it all the time, but there also has been a massive push out of, you know, for lending that has really sort of any risk on it has gotten pushed out of the banking sector and is now done by, you know, things like private credits or REITs or, you know, or just, you know, companies like Apollo or whoever who's making these, who are non-bank entities, who are nevertheless sort of stepping into the lower quality loan market, which has been a trend for some time. So I think where you see maybe some more distress is on that side. But the positive element of that, which is obviously the point of the regulations in the first place, was that the person on the other end of that, so the person who's loaning into that, is fully aware of their risk and is likely probably not going to get bailed out, but is also sort of signing up for an investment that has risk associated with it, as opposed to putting money in a bank and then realizing that the bank went under and realizing that you can't get your money out. And so I think that that kind of helps align some of the losses in those sort of categories with the, you know, it aligns sort of the ultimate investor or the ultimate funder of these loans with, you know, with the risk that's associated. So I guess that's one point. And then the second point, I just agreed a ton with what Sam mentioned about just the, you know, the duration, which is everybody went out and termed out their debt when rates were at 0% from 2020 to early 2022. And so a lot of that debt, you know, is still outstanding. When you have defaults start to come in, it's most often when these things come to maturity and they can't get refinanced. So typically people aren't missing their interest payments, but if they can't take out their debt and they can't find a solution where they can refinance in some way, that's when problems happen. And so if you think about 3 to 5 year cycle, it is reasonable to think that those are going to continue to increase to the extent that rates stay where they are. Now, obviously, I think everybody who's in those situations is eagerly awaiting for rate cuts, including lenders and borrowers. And that's sort of the broad expectation. That's what the Fed suggests in their dot plots. And likely that might be the case. But to the extent that we held at these levels, I think it would start to create a problem, and that would accelerate in the coming years.
And I would just hit on a couple of those points. One is the use of aggregate data, and I think this is one of the real challenges, conceals the bifurcation that I'm referring to. And so if, as I like to joke, if Bill Gates and I walk into a bar together, there's a couple of billionaires on average in that bar. We're seeing the same thing within the banking sector, where yes, because JP Morgan represents 15% of the bank deposits in the banking system, and we have a highly concentrated banking system relative to what we've had before, we are not seeing distress within the broad metrics, but we're very much seeing distress within the local metrics. Again, that puts more pressure on areas that rely on regional banks and on smaller banks for financing. Small business would be a great example of that. CRE is, of course, one. So as much of residential housing away from the national home builders. Those are issues that will ultimately have to be addressed. And I would just highlight that the use of the phrase, right, those risks appear contained, is an unfortunate echo to the same realization around the global financial crisis. I don't think that's quite the same thing, though, because of something else that somebody pointed out, or a couple of people have pointed out, which is an important use of the phrase equity versus debt. What really caused the global financial crisis was the perception that AAA credit was valid and low risk, and as a result, there was multiple layers of leverage that were placed on it. As that unwound, it created what we call the global financial crisis, as people discovered that the collateral that they had was not appropriate or was not actually the quality that they had expected. The dynamic around how large it is becomes a question of whether we're talking about the economy or whether we're talking about financial markets. In equity markets, the Russell 2000 is now, I believe, only about 3% of US market cap. As a result, when they talk about the median company in the Russell 2000, who cares? At the same time, small businesses, Russell 2000, et cetera, account for about 30% of employment in the United States. As a result, with government, both federal, state, and local, and large businesses accounting for most of the remainder, as a result, we're actually talking about a significant impact on potential employment and potential spending capability. That's what I'm much more concerned about. And so, you know, when we come to that dynamic, we talk about the risks that exist within the system. Most of the larger companies are actually reasonably well placed. They're running extraordinarily high profit margins. Those are quite suspicious in many ways, but they are what they are. Now the question becomes, if we experience a slowdown, do we see margins pressured in ways that ultimately lower the quality of many of the credits that we're talking about? We can't possibly know. And again, as Chum points out, it does become a question of timing. If we see economic weakness, that timing will arrive much faster.
Something you said there, Michael, about especially in the case of small businesses, maybe even medium businesses, Jeffrey Gundlach said that the U.S. economy is certainly headed for a recession as well as a wave of company failures. The way he said that is what you take out is the people, small businesses and medium businesses, as they'll run out of cash borrowing at 10% instead of at 4%. So, Joseph, and then to kick it around the panel, how likely is it that this comes to pass? Are we in store for mass small business failure due to those borrow rates?
So I'm not as bearish on the economy as Jeff Gundlach. So from the way that I look at this, when you're running a 6% fiscal deficit, you're constantly adding cash flows into the economy, and that's part of the reason why you have nominal growth continuing to be pretty good. And if you're continually adding cash flows into the economy, well, that makes debt serviceable. And so I think it takes away a lot of the tail risk scenarios. And in addition to that, so rates are at 5.5%. There's a lot of room. It could go down. Now, when we were in the low interest rate environment, again, Fed never wants to go negative, but when you're at 5.5%, you could, if the economy really did do very poorly, you could see rates cut very quickly, very significantly. And I think that would help the economy heal. So first, I don't think there is a lot of risk to the economy, but even if something poorly materializes, the policymakers have shown a willingness to deploy tools quickly to kind of cut away the left tail risk.
Thank you, Joseph. Any comments to that regarding small business?
I think one of the things important to recognize in terms of the structure of small business is, first of all, that something like 70%+ of small businesses don't borrow basically at all. And the reason why that is that a lot of those businesses are locked out of credit. They just are not borrowers in the economy on an ongoing basis. And so, you know, interest rates can be whatever they are, and it doesn't make much of a difference to them. And even those that are borrowing are typically not doing it for long-term leverage reasons, and are instead doing it for more transactional reasons. So, you know, you might borrow a little bit. You might borrow as a construction business to, you know, finance the building of a house and then sell the house or something like that. But it's not a long-term, you know, it's not like issuing a 30-year bond and having to pay the debt service at 10%. That's the vast majority of small businesses are not that credit sensitive. And part of the way that you can understand that is if you look at the NFIB survey and, you know, businesses get asked basically, what is the most important thing that's a concern to you? And by an order of magnitude, inflation is conveyed as the bigger concern. Inflation and labor quality and difficulty finding labor is an order of magnitude bigger, you know, more frequent major concern or primary concern for small businesses than is borrowing. And so you add that all up, it highlights the fact that actually the small business sector it's very income sensitive in the sense of they need to continue to have their sales growth occur. And it's inflation and cost input sensitive, but it's not particularly yield sensitive or interest rate sensitive. And so, you know, I mean, I said earlier this week, like if you're a Main Street oriented Fed, if you're actually worried about what the concern is on Main Street, the concern on Main Street is inflation. The concern on Main Street is not the current level of interest rates.
Anybody have anything to add to Bob's thoughts there?
So I'll just add that, I mean, we've heard a number of people comment that inflation is above the Fed's target and all that, and that's totally true. And CPI today continues to be, you know, 3%, something like that. Looks like it's sticky around there. But the Fed's target is PCE, and PCE last time was 2.7. If you look at the Cleveland Fed nowcast, it looks like Cleveland Fed is thinking that the next print will be around 2.6. So I think of inflation as above the Fed's target, but kind of the story of the past. Like, it is above the Fed's target, but 2.7, 2.6 is very, very different from the 7% we saw a couple years ago. Now, a lot of people are complaining about inflation, but I think what they really mean is the price level. And I don't think that's coming down. And I don't think the policymakers will even try to have deflation. So it seems like from just looking at inflation, that's largely solved. I mean, it's going to be above the Fed's target, but not disastrously so. It's the price level that people don't like, and that's probably not going to change.
I'm going to go on record here saying that the Fed will end up cutting 100 basis points or so in the next, call it 6 months or more. And when they do, that inflation will spike. And it will spike, by several percentage points at a minimum, and become much more difficult to control. I think they're about to make a significant mistake. That's my humble opinion. But again, we will see here. I think we will see there will be more signs and pressure also from politicians to continue to cut into a worsening employment picture. But again, ultimately, I think that will prove to be a significant mistake. And I do think we are at near-term bottoms in inflation.
So that actually leads me, I definitely got to get some other people's takes on the 100 bips projection, because when we last spoke, we had already seen the projections of number of rate cuts within 2024 drop from as high as 6 to none. And actually, according to a recent poll by Reuters, a majority of forecasters indicated that they believe the Fed will cut once in September and then perhaps one more time after that. So I do want to kick this one around the panel, starting with Joseph, because Joseph, you said yourself that the Fed will join those central banks we mentioned earlier. But I'm kind of curious on what you guys are feeling in terms of the timeline and how much.
So just by way to set the stage, in March, the dot plots guided towards 3 cuts this year. Now, between then and now, we've had inflation progressing slower than the Fed would like. And Chair Powell made a point to just say that he's not happy with progress. And so bearing that in mind, the market has repriced that. And I think a plurality of people expect the dot plot today to have 2 cuts this year. I think that's in line with what I think the Fed will do. But from the Fed's perspective, I think they're going to be more concerned about rising unemployment now. Now, inflation still above target, but it's 2.6, 2.7 is not that serious. But you do have unemployment rate rising steadily over the past few months and most recently printing at 4%. The Fed thinks that it's being really restrictive, and so I think it's going to follow the other countries and kind of moderate its restrictiveness a little bit. If you look at what President Lagarde or Governor McNamara are saying, they're framing their policy decisions by way of saying that they are still restrictive, but just being slightly less so. And from the Fed's perspective, as we discussed earlier, they all kind of look at the world the same way. I think that's the way the Fed looks at it as well. So I actually think the Fed is still going to cut maybe three times this year, probably starting in September and continuing with November and December. I suspect that the labor market data is going to surprise. The unemployment rate will rise faster than the Fed thinks, simply because we have so much migration that's putting upward pressure on it, and the economy is moderating in its demand for labor.
I want to add one thing. To be clear, when I said in the next 6 to 12 months, I agree. I think we'll have 2 to 3, much like the market is saying, probably 3 this year. I think the important part that the market and certain entities are missing is that we will likely have a new president next year. And if you think that there's not going to be pressure, a la Nixon on Arthur Burns, for more stimmy from the Fed in the face of the potential argument of, hey, the economy is slowing, look at unemployment numbers, I think people are missing that. And I think that's a mistake, as we've seen in the past. And I think we're about to make a similar mistake that we've made in the past. And I think that that's not a coincidence. It's because history rhymes and the political forces are very similar.
I want to add on to Chip's point really quickly. So what we've seen recently is political choices can have huge impacts on markets. Looking at Mexico, for example, the Mexican election resulted in just the peso getting clobbered, Mexican stock market getting clobbered. In November, the two candidates have some really big differences in policy. As Jim alluded to, President Trump very openly telling you he would like to have lower interest rates and a weaker dollar. That's a recipe for just a complete surge in some financial assets and, of course, lower interest rates. Now, if you have President Biden being reelected, well, we know over the past few years that President Biden really likes immigration. We've increased our population by millions and millions. And that's going to put upward pressure on things like housing, maybe downward pressure on some wages as well. Now, we had a discussion about housing earlier. Again, like Mike and Bob mentioned, we have supply constraints, not helped by high interest rates. But if you continue to have increasing population, then demand for housing is going to increase as well. Looking at New York City, and migration is unequally distributed across the country, but in New York City, the vacancy rates are at multi-decade lows. So that's in part because there are just so many migrants moving there.
So I do want to touch a little bit on the topic of employment and wages, and kind of how they affect the likelihood of those cuts. So we did see the non-farm payrolls increase pretty significantly by 272,000, by far surpassing that expected 180K. And the average hourly earnings also grew a bit in May as well, by 0.4%, both figures much stronger than anticipated. So to Michael, I'd like your take on wages, as you posted about them before, and how do these strong numbers affect the likelihood of Fed rate cuts this year? And kind of as a tail on that, are the numbers as strong as they appear, Michael?
I mean, look, I think that there are arguments in both directions. I think Joseph hit on a really important one with the immigration component. One of the ways we can reconcile the non-farm payrolls with the household sector presumes census numbers are largely accurate and projects ratios off of responses as compared to attempting to measure directly. Non-farm payrolls is much more of an attempt to measure directly. So if we have a large surge in population, it can lead to a significantly higher non-farm payroll number than the household, with that being far less problematic than the alternative, right? Which is the data is just wrong. And my hunch is that there's a mixture of those two that are actually playing through. I'm just about to post a chart that I'll tag into the space that looks at just how far extended we are on NFP versus household. And you know, one of the things that I think is actually important is in most situations, that's not actually a recession signal as much as it is a signal of significant mismeasurement. And the quick answer is, I don't know. I think that both are actually credible. We know that many of the survey techniques, things like the birth death, are being revised downwards by QCEW, the quarterly census of employment and wages. So we know the number is likely too high. On the flip side, I think there's a reasonable chance that the household number is too low. And you know, the resolution of those two is going to be one of the interesting dynamics. The uncertainty you hear in my voice, though, is one of the reasons why we try to avoid central planning. And changing the risk-free rate for the entire economy is one of the most egregious forms of central planning. We don't know what the right answer is, and we don't know what the number should be because of all the uncertainties that we're talking about. Increasingly, we behave as if it matters whether we get a 2.8 or a 2.7 on CPI. I would suggest that, you know, Joseph alluded to this before, when we're at 6.5 and 7, we can talk about whether the data is right or wrong, but we know that we need to do something to slow the economy. As we're decelerating from 6.5 to 2.5, that's a much harder discussion. And I think that's where the Fed is largely trapped right now. I don't think we know the right answer. We're seeing signs of distress in a bifurcated economy. We're also seeing extraordinary signs of speculation that can be interpreted in multiple ways. So, you know, this is a period of we've been truly blessed with the Chinese curse of may you live in interesting times.
At the end of the day, there is a desire politically to keep the demand push economy intact and continue to move money to the median outcome. And as long as that continues to be the case, where interest rates now have asymmetric pressure on the economy, given the pent-up demand in real estate, I think you'd be, you know, you put yourself in a very dangerous position to argue that inflation is coming back into line. I think, if anything, the next excuse to stimulate monetarily should cause an asymmetric increase in inflation.
I just, you know, if you look through time, like central banks are notoriously, let's say, slow moving in their decision-making process, both from the perspective that they need to see data and then they need to build a consensus around it. And if you're sitting in the Fed shoes and you see, you know, sure, the unemployment rate has meandered up from the mid threes to 4, but certainly nothing indicates that there's any meaningful or substantive slowdown, particularly if you look across all the different employment indications that you can be looking at. You know, there's not a lot of evidence that there's an acute slowdown. There's some evidence that hiring is a bit soft, but on the flip side, there's reasonable evidence that involuntary layoffs and discharges is also very soft. And so that whole picture, there's no urgency to be responsive to the employment situation right now. And so if you're sitting in the Fed shoes, I guess the question is, you know, why cut? Like, what's the urgency? What motivates you to have to do anything at this point? And will simply the inertia of, you know, the inertia of the prudence of gathering more information outweigh the need to move or any desire to move more quickly in the short term?
So we got about 6 minutes until we get some numbers here regarding FOMC, but I do want to dive a little bit further on this and to the panel as a whole. Feel free to chime in, anyone. Private payrolls have seen their growth slow to 152,000 in May per ADP, which is much less than that consensus estimate of 175,000 and the lowest monthly level since January of this year. In addition to this, annual pay growth gains held at 5%, where they've been for, I think, the last 3 consecutive months. ADP's chief economist said we're monitoring notable pockets of weakness tied to both producers and consumers. So to the panel, and we can start with Joseph and kick her around, does this indicate further sluggishness in the labor market?
Well, first off, ADP has not been a very good predictor of NFP, and I think the NFP plays a bigger role in the Fed's thinking. Now, to what Bob mentioned earlier, and very good reference to Governor Waller's speech, why would the Fed what Fed can just wait and not do anything, right? But I think this labor question, market question that you raised, Nicholas, is why that it might want to do something. And that is unemployment rate bottom at around 3.4%. It's been steadily rising to 4%. So unemployment, as we know, through things like the SAM rule or the Dudley rule, has some degree of momentum. And we also know that the Fed thinks that monetary policy acts with long and variable lags. And it also thinks that it's extremely restrictive. So if you put things together, it would make sense why they would want to moderate their constraints a little bit. I think it's the labor market that they're concerned of, and they don't want to over-tighten.
Thank you, Joseph. Anyone have an add to that?
I would just emphasize the same points that he's making, which is that we know that these work with long and variable lags. We are seeing signs of increasing distress in at least some segments of the economy. If we're discussing whether it's a mistake or not, I think that that's going to be something that's reserved for the history books. I think it's rarely tough to know. I think what's unfortunate is that our policymakers are incapable of making fiscal decisions that could actually solve some of these problems. For example, a significant stimulus to supply, as we had in the post-World War II environment, when there were similar shortages of housing and there were tremendous efforts made by the federal government, state and local governments, to free up capacity and increase the housing supply. That may end up happening, but it's happening very, very slowly. There's actually a couple of good tweets and examples that are coming from places like Costco that are beginning to build sponsored housing so that they can expand within urban environments. That's actually very similar to the type of behavior that happened in New York City in the aftermath of World War II, where insurance companies expended a tremendous amount of private capital to build places like Peter Cooper Village and Stuyvesant Town to address the shortages of housing that were going to occur with the return of the soldiers. So I'd like to see that happen. I don't see any strong indications that that sort of leadership is coming. And in the meantime, unfortunately, we're using a very, very blunt tool to try to solve very specific policy problems. So to summarize the conclusion of that, I think the Fed will end up cutting. Whether that stimulates inflation or not, I think is really much more a function of other policies.
Fair enough, Michael. Thank you. We have 2 minutes until we should get some numbers, so this next one might get a brief interruption, and then we'll come right back to it after we take our cursory glance at the release. One thing I wanted to touch on, and I'm going to pick on Last Bear and Jem for this one, starting with Last Bear. According to CNN, the U.S. stock market is quote-unquote shrinking, and investors are pulling money out at a near-record pace. But from what I'm seeing as someone who basically, I mean, my entire focus is options, options flow, net premiums across the market. What I'm seeing is seemingly a lot of buying. So I'm curious, Last Bear, does this ring true in what you're seeing? Are people really pulling that money out at record paces?
I guess I wouldn't have guessed that that would be the case. I'm not sure what metrics they're looking at to justify that article, but I think that there are, like, if you just look at money market money fund assets, they are substantially higher than they were 2 years ago. But a lot of that's rate driven and people sort of shifting from deposits towards money market funds and whatnot. And I don't know that that's too unusual. I think if you look at sentiment in the market for the past, you know, since October has been, you know, quite bullish, quite strong. I think if you look at just more recently, if you're looking at put call ratios, that sort of thing, that sort of the call buying that we saw dominate markets for the entire sort of COVID bull run, maybe not coming back to the same level, but if you look at sort of the difference between calls and puts, but coming back to a really strong level in recent days. And so I don't see that being the case. I think it's hard if you're someone who looks at markets and looks at price action and looks at popular stocks and does all that kind of stuff to come to the conclusion that investors are, you know, rapidly pulling money out of the market.
Thank you, Last Bear. Jem, what are you seeing, especially in terms of, even if you want to touch on volatility, that'd be great. But what are you seeing in the flows?
Look, there's a reason we've come out with this this comment about kind of the summer of George. What is the summer of George about? There is so much liquidity when I say liquidity, so much supportive flows during this time, not just directionally positive, but really in terms of vol supply on these markets. It's a function of both structured, you know, product demand, which has been through the roof, and the amount of supply that that means for banks. It is a function of both lower vol levels and broadly Fed and fiscal support that continues to flow in to markets. And in the absence of a tail appearing, what that does is that drives end of month, beginning of month positive flows, beginning of day, end of day Vana charm flows, OPEX, June quarterly OPEX here, you know, drives all of these buyback flows that we talk so much about. And not only does it drive the positive push in markets, but it also drives, you know, the important, you know, increasing vol supply going forward. So as you, you know, as you push through these, more and more vol gets pushed onto the market and it reflexively pushes things lower. So, you know, this is what we talked about a month and a half ago now. It's been pretty much textbook we've seen now for a month and a half. It's like watching paint dry, right? It is a very stable supported market. Now, to be clear, that's at the index level, you know, and we've talked about this a ton, but the more that the vol is supplied at the index level, it, you know, the more it exacerbates counterintuitively the dispersion of the market and the breakdown in breadth, the breakdown in beta one, right, to the market. It, because things like NVIDIA are short vol centers and they go up on beating earnings, right? The rest of the market has to go the other way, as we saw on the NVIDIA earnings day, for example. Seems counterintuitive, but what you see is, again, a mass selling and everything else because the vol in the market is broadly supplied. The index cannot move too fast based on supply and demand. And if NVIDIA is going to move fast, everything else has to be under pressure to allow for those arbitrage constraints. So the summer of George is not just about a placid market. It is about a well-supported market at the index level that continues to grind higher in a low vol environment, but that exacerbates movement under the hood as a function of dispersion. And I think that's the big picture. That's exactly what we've seen. If you know, if you listen to what I said a month and a half ago, you made a lot of money on all those things. And it's not over. We have another, you know, month or so throughout the summer. Now, eventually what this leads to is too much risk taking on the short vol side, too much long positioning in the market. And as that liquidity and that vol supply slowly gets unpinned as you get towards the fall, it's more likely to end up in a more volatile circumstance, either this fall going into the election or probably more likely early next year. So this would not be the time to get out in front and try and short markets, as we've talked about with others. And then people can kind of see that. Not a time to go burn theta, despite vol looking super cheap. But it is a time to start looking towards the fall and early, more importantly, next year, and taking advantage of the flows that are there to position appropriately then.
The dots took out two cuts.
Yeah, this is a hawkish dot plot, just one cut for the year. And in addition to that, there's another revision upwards of the neutral rate to 2.8%. Still really low, I think, but it moved up from 2.6 to 2.8. And it also moved up the median expectation of the longer-term unemployment rate. So that suggests to me there's, you know, more room for unemployment to go up before they feel like there's more of a trade-off.
Yeah, I mean, there's still probably 120 basis points too low on the median or on the long-term Fed funds rate, but we're moving in the right direction here. Pretty remarkable that they, you know, unemployment rate at 4 by the end of the year, and only one cut in response to that. That suggests, you know, a pretty, you know, they're pretty hawkish in terms of the dot plot for sure. Probably because they see that the core PCE inflation number they're putting down at 2.8, which is too high for their mandate, pretty clearly too high.
Any other comments at a glance here from the?
I should also say it's pretty remarkable, very little response from the markets, given this reaction function that's being implied by the dots. I don't know if people are just taking some time to digest it or wait for what they're hearing Chairman Powell say, but it's a muted reaction relative to, I think, how meaningful this indication is.
I agree. I wonder if maybe Jim could add about the options flow.
Yeah, I want to be clear. This is exactly what I'm saying. So, you know, it was pretty clear, right, on the NVIDIA beat that when NVIDIA was up big, everybody just scratching their head, right? Like, if you go back to that day, how could the market end up down to slightly unch on that day? It's the flows. It's the vol supply. It's supply and demand. Markets price based on supply and demand in any period less than a year or two. And I want to be clear, like, this matters for the medium term, right? This is a liquidity, potential liquidity withdrawal if you were to take it at face value, but not today, tomorrow, right? Again, I think the core is vol supply here is very, very well supplied. And that just drives structural buying into June OPEX, into end of quarter.
Not 100% related to that, but Jim, to your comment earlier about the NVIDIA split, it was interesting because as soon as it happened, Apple very quickly dominated the bullish net premiums. But today, NVIDIA has reclaimed their throne, at least for the interim.
Yeah, I mean, dispersion doesn't have to be one directional, right? But it's the point that, you know, if something's going to move, it 2x's the correlation move, because that means something has to move the other way. Ironically, a pinning of the market with inline idiosyncratic risk means correlation must break down.
Last Bear and Michael, do you have any comments to the drop before I move along to the next line of questions?
Yeah, I think it's tough to see anything that's super positive in the dots. I agree with everyone that it is hawkish. You have unemployment rate increasing, inflation expectations increasing, and the federal funds rate increasing. So it's hard to find the good news, or bad news is good news in that scenario. But I am also a little bit surprised as how little markets have moved between rates and equities. I'm sure that the getting past the announcement, you have the vol supply come in. But it does seem maybe a little bit out of step based on what I sort of felt was the expectation coming into the meeting. But it could also be that maybe folks just aren't paying as much attention to the dot plots because they recognize that the Fed hasn't been stellar at predicting where that's going to go and where rates are going to settle for some time now. So not any change on the headline rate, obviously. No one expected one, but not a negative reaction to the dots.
One thing I want to touch on, at least briefly, is bond yields. And I'm going to kick this one off with you, Bob. You recently tweeted about the bond yields, quote, feeling stuck in a tight 50 bips range around 4.5%. And you stated not going much higher, alluding to the Fed and to the Treasury. Bob, can you walk us through what you're seeing go on in the bonds market and why you feel they may not go much higher? You also stated that there might be less opportunity to the downside. So I am curious about your thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're stuck to some extent in a range here in the bond market where you know, if you get down into the, you know, the 425 or, you know, the low end of the fours, that starts to create enough stimulation and enough equity strength to start to put pressure for the yields to rise. And then if you sort of move towards the top end of that range, so 475, you know, 480, something like that, I think there's at least a real question. You know, I think a lot of folks think that based upon the behavior of the Fed and the Treasury at the end of last year, that there's essentially a put in the market at five. And so they'll come in with a shifted policy stance in the event that that occurs, that we get bond yields up there. And so you put that, those sort of two pieces together, and you kind of get this bouncing from one direction to another. I think, you know, I think the 10-year before the Fed, you know, I think it literally bounced at 425 and now is rising with the dots. We'll see if it stays in that range, but that's kind of, we're kind of at a equilibrium point there with the bond yield moving between those two ranges, an equilibrium point where still inflation is too high and the economy is still a little too strong given what the Fed's mandate is. But the question is, what will break that mold, that range bound situation? You know, I think it's probably on the downside, we need to have a really significant downside growth surprise, which, you know, I don't see the data coming in that way, at least at this point. I think on the upside, the question is basically, if you start to see, you know, strong enough growth and say we get an inflation print that's a little hotter than what the sort of noisy downside that we saw today, and, you know, a Fed that's speaking a little more hawkishly, that's kind of the mix to go above 475. But I think the real question is that really, you know, is there a real appetite for policymakers to accept anything meaningfully higher than that? 525, 550? Like, will they accept that? I'm not sure.
I do recall on our last panel, we did briefly discuss a couple of pundits who were pushing for the notion of five and beyond. And so based on what Bob's saying here, does Joseph, Jem, or Last Bear have anything to add to that area? So I do want to pivot back here to that topic of inflation and the notion of higher for longer. Using some comments by President of the ECB, Christine Lagarde's comments, she mentioned her confidence there in inflation coming down to 2%, and the stated rate of inflation is basically halved. However, here in the States, the inflation rate has been above 3% for 37 or 38 consecutive months now, and that's, I believe, the longest period since the late 80s going into the 90s per Charlie Baleo. So, Joseph, how are you viewing the rate of inflation in the U.S., especially given this morning's CPI print, the updated dots on the Fed release just now? Are there any solid signs of inflation slowing in the States?
Oh, yeah. A couple years ago, core PCE was like 7%. Now it's like 2.7%. So there's been a lot of progress, but the progress has stalled over the past few months. It looks like it's stuck a bit above 2%. And I think that makes sense given how large the fiscal deficit is. Now, with respect to, you know, is the Fed worried about inflation staying above target for such a long time? I think the measure of that is whether or not inflation expectations become unanchored. Because from the Fed's perspective, you know, being standard economists and so forth, they place enormous amounts of weight on the inflation expectations of the public. They think that if the public begins to expect higher inflation, inflation will also move up. So from what they say, and looking at the New York Fed surveys and University of Michigan surveys, it seems like inflation expectations remain, at least at the median level, remain anchored. So even though inflation has been above target for a long time, I don't think that worries them. And of course, their projections are going to tell you that it's coming back to 2%. But I think it always says that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption to make. So just kind of on that topic of recession, and back to the New York Fed, even their most recent estimates places the chances of slipping into a downturn in the U.S. at 50-50. And I'm curious from the panel in general, is it actually 50-50, or is the propensity for recession and that dramatic downturn some have been calling for it seems like years now that we just really haven't seen, is that more or less likely than the New York Fed's projected 50-50?
I'll take a shot at it, I guess. I think it's been hard. I think that part of the challenge in macro for the past 4 years has been that this cycle has been extremely unusual, obviously going back to COVID and the disruption that it caused, but you know how it impacted different industries differently and how they've sort of rebounded and recessed in some cases. And you sort of have this, you know, fluctuations that have made traditional economic cycle indicators very hard to use. And so that's been a challenge to sort of work through. And I guess my perspective, even when we're talking about like labor dynamics, I know we talked about it a lot earlier, but you can trace those lines of labor slowdown, whether it be in hiring rates or quit rates, or whether it's in the total number of unemployed people, or you know, all the major metrics that we look at as being sort of somewhat forward-looking on labor. And you can see that those have been slowly deteriorating for 2 years or so. And so that caused a lot of people to create recession calls way too early. And obviously, you know, when the risk is once you start to see an uptick in unemployment is that it accelerates and it's not a linear progression. But it's been, you know, that's proven to be a wrong call for a long time. And I think a lot of it does have to do with sort of the strange circumstances that, you know, sort of led to the economic situation that we're in. And so from my perspective, rather than trying to put a specific percent on it, is to not try to sort of call it in advance. Like, you don't get any credit for getting it right before, you know, somebody else is, because you're often going to be too early and you're going to miss out on what otherwise is a growing economy. And so it's really to focus, the way that I look at it is just to, you know, keep an eye on all these indicators and, you know, not to be blind to them, but to wait until you see sort of the whites in the eyes. So like, you know, if unemployment jumps, you know, 2.2% or 0.3% or 0.4% or something like that in the next month or two, then like pay attention and don't ignore that sign. But to be so focused on sort of these cyclical indicators, sort of, you know, recession predictions, I think it's been the wrong place to be for some time. And I don't know that that's about to change.
I would echo both sides of that, actually. I think one of the big challenges, and I wrote about this in my Substack, is how much the S&P has moved from a leading indicator to a lagging indicator over the course of, you know, the past several decades. You know, my theories around the impact of passive investing are certainly influencing my read on that. But empirically, we now know that stock markets just do not respond in advance of economic activity in the way that they used to. We've gone from an environment where 6 months prior to the recession, we were typically halfway through the drawdown, to the past several recessions have literally coincided with peaks in the stock market, if not peaks in the stock market coming in the month after the recession begins. So it's, you know, trying to predict the macroeconomic cycle has been a mistake.
So Bob, you touched on this topic of recession at a fairly good length on Twitter the other day, stating, quote, "The early stage dynamics of a recession have yet to actually occur in the United States. And until they shift, this moderating growth can continue to happen, but a recession is unlikely to come." Can you walk us through that, Bob?
Well, I mean, the first thing I echo the comments here where, look, there's a lot about this cycle that we don't understand and is unfamiliar with to us, certainly in our professional careers. And so part of the way to navigate it is by being data dependent yourself in terms of, you know, not getting overly reliant on your projection of what you think is going to happen relative to, you know, looking at the data that's coming in and understanding that and interpreting it effectively, and certainly being open-minded that the cycle may be different than what you necessarily expect. The point that I was saying in that thread is that recessions, at least if you look back through time, they don't just sort of happen out of the blue. I mean, of course, there's exogenous shocks like COVID, where, you know, that you know, a recession happened for reasons that I think pretty much nobody predicted. Certainly no macro specialists predicted. But if you're talking about sort of a more typical recession, you know, there's certain things that have to happen. And in particular, what you have to see is you have to see an impetus for a slowdown in spending, particularly relative to income. And so that can happen, you know, in some cases where you have elevated credit creation that sort of reaches its limit combined with monetary tightening, and that creates a shift in, you know, slowing of credit and a slowing of demand and knocks off, you know, creates the recessionary dynamic, self-reinforcing recessionary dynamic. I think what's happening now is not really that, because, you know, credit growth is basically as weak as it's been ever in the last, you know, in the last couple of years. And so much more we have sort of the income-driven expansion, supported by the continued substantial fiscal deficits, and that something there has to change. So people's propensity to spend relative to save has to go down. And so the question is, how will you know whether it's going down? And there you have to think about the linkages of what causes someone to slow their spending relative to their income. So either, you know, the most likely circumstance is that we would see asset prices fall as the leading indicator of then a shift in spending of then, which would lead to a self-reinforcing process of recession. So but you have to see that happen first before you get the recession. And so, you know, stock prices at new highs and bond yields, you know, relatively contained and house prices surging, you put those things together, it's just not a recipe for why you expect a recession to happen ahead.
I'd also add that in addition, so, I mean, recession being the economy is producing fewer goods and services as it did before. I mean, when you're adding millions of people, you are mechanically adding labor. So that increases production, makes it less likely for there to be a proper recession. But you could have a recession on a per capita basis, as we see happening in Canada. Now, also, you know, I know that the market is muted and I understand there's all these options dynamics in the equity market. But what really surprises me is the 2-year is basically not doing anything. It's like the Fed is losing its magic. It comes out with this hawkish dot plot in what you should be the most sensitive part to the dot plot. Shorter dated interest rates are just not doing anything. Seeing if Chair Powell will try to talk some magic to try to change that.
Yeah, I would also echo that. I think it's actually quite interesting. If you look at the move, particularly in the December SOFR futures, for example, it's very muted relative to what this dot plot would suggest.
I mean, it's like the market doesn't believe whatever the Fed is predicting, which isn't necessarily an unreasonable interpretation. I do wonder, over what time frame will the dots become less interesting, because there will be an increasing recognition that, you know, the Fed and the folks there have no idea what's going to transpire. They're not in the prediction business. Their predictions are noise. And instead what they're doing is responding to the data, and that most people, I guess, are essentially focused on what they expect the data to be going ahead, much more than what they expect the dots to be.
Thank you so much to all of you. We've got about 5 minutes here before Jerome Powell's presser begins. What I want to do, just as I do on all other panels, I just want to run down the line for any closing thoughts, anything you didn't want to miss out on that we didn't maybe touch during the panel, just a quick brief overview. And of course, if you have anything coming out, anything you're working on that you want our listeners to be privy to, please feel free to plug it. So we'll start off here with Michael. Any closing thoughts here for the listeners?
No, I mean, I just think that, you know, I'm surprised by what's happening in the rates market. I agree with some of the observations that this boils down to the market dismissing what feels like relatively important information, waiting for Powell. So this could be a delayed reaction. This also could be a sign that the market increasingly is saying they're just as uncertain as we are, so we shouldn't pay that much attention to anything they say. Or candidly, nobody cares anymore. We're heading into the summer, and there's a reasonable chance that that's really the underlying story.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks for coming again, man. I always love having your input here.
I enjoy participating.
Joseph, anything you want to send the folks off into the presser with?
Yeah, I think like I alluded to earlier and discussed with Jem, I think going forward, we should be paying more attention to how the election would turn out. I think that's going to be a big change in policy that's going to have a big impact on markets. And going forward, it's probably going to be more important than what the Fed is going to do. So I would pay more attention to the politics of the U.S. And so I have a YouTube channel. It's called Joseph Wang, and I will post my FOMC debrief on it afterwards.
Good deal, Joseph. Everybody be sure to check that out for sure. And all of these panelists, to be completely frank, there's a lot of information these folks put out for free on the regular, so don't miss out on it. Bob, anything you want to add before we kick into the presser?
You know, nothing in particular. I think great conversation, lots of interesting things that we've been able to bat around. You know, maybe markets are just waiting for Powell to reinforce what's going on with the dots, but you know, we'll have to wait and see. If folks want to get a regular flow of macro takes, you know, obviously follow me on Twitter, and also if you're more into the YouTube thing, we've got a YouTube channel also under at Bobby Unlimited. So definitely check that out.
Thank you as always, Bob. Jem, anything you want to add here at the end?
Yeah, I mean, to Joseph's point, we're 6 months out from a new president, potentially. That's dramatically different. In the meantime, we are in the heart of election season. Doesn't seem like it to a lot of people, but it is. That is what we are about to be in full time. And there are massive policy effects of that. It's honestly shocking that there's not more talk about this election. But the reality is, during election years, regardless of the outcome, in the meantime, we are in a time of stimulus. And don't confuse these short-term flows, both from a macro perspective and a short-term summer liquidity perspective, for truth. For what actually matters. So you need to look at them now, trade based on them now, but that does not mean that the macro and the realities of what are happening are any different than what they actually are. So I think that's so critical. You need to look at the flows, watch them, trade them. That is a supply and demand reality of the voting machine. Don't try and bet based on macro in the short term. But know that the reaction from this election after the short-term placidity will likely be significant next year.
Thank you, as always, Jem, for your input there. Last Bear, any closing thoughts? Anything you're working on?
Yeah, if you guys like anything that I've said, you can follow me here on Twitter, or you can follow my Substack. I put out a long-form piece every single Friday. So check that out if you want. Otherwise, just thanks for inviting me to the spaces, and always enjoy the time.
Thanks as always for coming. Folks, if you're not following everybody on this panel, please do so. They put out their own reports, their own takes on everything going on, and honestly, it's invaluable. I learn so much about how little I know every time I host these panels.